Legal Discussion on Tip Today is brought to you in association with Lynch Solicitors Clonmel, on the web at lynchsolicitors.ie and at divorceinireland.com.
And John Lynch from Lynch Solicitors is back from down under, in fact.
That's right. Bit cold down there.
Is it?
It's only 30 degrees.
Is that all? God, you poor old thing. How did you even... You were in Sydney,
yeah? I was in Sydney, yeah. And the funny thing is, we're talking about... banks and insolvency and all the rest. My sister actually works for the largest Commonwealth Bank in Australia. She's a legal advisor or whatever to them. And funny down there, they're struggling very much with bad PR, the banks. But what they seem to have to deal with, which hasn't yet really happened in Ireland, and I was actually trying to pick her brains, but she wouldn't give me the information. They've actually started a number of class actions against the banks. And we don't have such a thing as a class action.
It's not legal here to do that,
is it? They haven't set up the mechanism yet to do it. It's not part of our
system.
Just
explain a class action.
Yeah. A class action would be where, for example, the most... well-known one would be the thalidomide case.
Right.
And the thalidomide case in the US effectively meant that you were able to take a class action, which meant that you could represent 200,000 or 20,000 or however many different people of a particular class against a particular complainant, if you know what I mean. So in that case, they took the case against the drug company, and the class action meant that one judge effectively dealt with it and made kind of monetary compensation for the entire class, so that not everybody had to take a case against them in order to succeed.
So he set a precedent.
So he basically set out the framework for dealing with the case.
Right.
And he basically said, you know, this is the kind of range of damages I'm going to award, and if you fall into this category, you'll get this, etc. So that's a kind of a class action. So in Australia at the moment, there's quite a number of class actions against the banks. And it was really interesting for me to land and read the paper, because it was like reading what we had here. I was out there for 2 weeks. It was like reading what I was reading on the plane about the tracker mortgages. Because effectively what has happened, one of the class actions, for example, is where... because of a glitch within the computer system within the bank, they actually failed to record or report certain transactions to the regulator, which meant that certain transactions went in under the radar, and these transactions should have been reported and should have been, you know, it should have been monitored, if you know what I mean. And therefore, the class actions are people saying that if they had been monitored, people wouldn't have invested in them and they wouldn't have lost money, or they would have not made the investment at all, etc.
Okay.
So it's really interesting, because when you look at the tracker situation and how slow... And I don't think it's unfair to say that the banks have been slow in dealing with the tracker
situation. I don't think it's at all unfair, yeah.
Yeah, and if you take it that in our legal system, you effectively have to prove, you have to prove your case against the bank in each individual case. That's the difference between a class action and an individual action. So... we're at a huge disadvantage in a situation where if you take the small guy versus the bank, I mean, I was one of the things, again, you get time when you're on a 24-hour flight, you get time to think about various things. But one of the things that I thought was really interesting when I came back is that because of the way the fact of a class action and the fact that you can get multiple, in other words, you can make a huge group of people, put them together and take a case and not leave it to the one sole small guy to take on the bank or the banks. And I say the banks, any major institution. And one of the issues that I've certainly found down the years, and I would be reasonably passionate about it, is that our system doesn't allow for the small guy. You know, the small guy takes huge risks on board. So, for example, I have a case at the moment in the bankruptcy court against the assignee in bankruptcy. Now, it doesn't involve somebody in this area, so I don't think people needn't think that it's a local based client. But in this particular situation, the individual has to bear the risk, the cost, and the stress to take a case against the assignee in bankruptcy, which is a major institution funded and covered. So if I'm suing an individual who, if you like, you know the term putting skin in the game, I think, is that the term that's used? But where you don't have, where there's none of your own money at risk, where it's not, you know, it's institutional money.
Yes.
And then there's the private individual who has to take it on. There's a huge disadvantage there in terms of
You could be advising. Wiped out. You could be wiped out.
In the particular case that I have now, and it's a tricky one. I mean, from our point of view, you know, we often talk about the legal system, you know, and solicitors and costs, and you know, it's very expensive to take an action, but it's always been historically the case with solicitors that you'd often take on a pro bono type situation. And you would, because of the fact, and I'm not looking for a sainthood here now or anything, but you know, a lot of the reason that a number of people do law is that, if you like, they're driven by the fact that people should be represented. But in this particular case, I mean, the client is a very brave client, because we're in the High Court. We've taken on the assignee in bankruptcy. There was a preliminary point of law which went against us, but I reckoned, you know, we took the view that it was unfair. So we're appealing it to the Court of Appeal. We have the major case that's still going to run before the High Court. And throughout all of this, you're looking at a situation that if you lose the appeal, if you lose the substantive case, the client ends up having to face the cost of that. Now, reverse it and look at the assignee in bankruptcy. The assignee in bankruptcy doesn't have to pay anything.
Of course.
And I mean, I don't mean that. Obviously, it's, you know, taxpayers' money, because it's a public institution. But there's not the same
situation. It's not a personal hit.
You know, it's not a personal hit.
So to speak, yeah.
And, you know, again, in a similar type situation, and it's kind of on topic with what I was going to talk to you about this morning, you know, the whole area of bankruptcy and somebody going into bankruptcy for a year and coming out of it for a year, right? Under the bankruptcy legislation, there is an option there for the assignee in bankruptcy to apply to extend it. Now, this may seem like I'm having a go at the assignee, and I'm not. The legislation itself has a built-in mechanism for an application being made to extend somebody's bankruptcy. So, for example, let's take the one that most people would know, because it's in the public arena. Our friend McFeely, do you remember the time the money behind the bath, etc., etc.? Now, he went into bankruptcy, and his bankruptcy was extended. And the question is, you know, why was it extended? Usually, bankruptcy can be extended for two reasons. One, that you don't cooperate and you don't play ball at all. And two, that you do something to evade, you know, you prejudice the creditors by, for example, hiding money or whatever. Now, in the case of McFeely, it went to the High Court, and the High Court looked at it and said, look, this is an evasion and we're going to extend the bankruptcy. But take the other situation. Take the person who doesn't have any resources, and the assignee in bankruptcy decides, and we're dealing with the situation at the moment where the assignee decides, well, we want to extend this. And you say, well, why? Well, we want to extend it because we're not happy that the client, the bankrupt, gave us all the information. And you say, well, but they did, and here's the information. No, but we still want to extend it. Now, in a situation like that, there's no mechanism other than fighting it out, which I'm going to have to do in the High Court before a judge, and say to the judge, look, I don't think it's fair that this should be extended. I don't think it's within the legislation.
That's incredible. And without them having proof, they can make that decision.
Well, no, they will say they have proof, because they will file. The way that it's dealt with is it's done in the bankruptcy court, and in an awful lot of cases that similar to this type of situation, you deal with it on affidavit evidence. So affidavit evidence, what's affidavit evidence as opposed to what you might usually watch when you're watching the telly and you see somebody goes into the witness box, they give their evidence and you cross-examine them on their evidence, etc., etc. So normally these things are dealt with by affidavit evidence. And affidavit evidence is effectively somebody swearing up an affidavit saying, I've looked at this, this is what I see, and therefore I conclude that it should be extended. So in the particular scenario that we're dealing with, and we have a number of them at the moment, they're literally setting out information on an affidavit, which is a matter very much for dispute whether you should or should not be extending the bankruptcy. But the point that I'm making is you're dealing with somebody who's bankrupt, and it's the cost of defending this. Because you're going into the High Court. Mm. You're not going into the Circuit Court or the District
Court. So you need to have money to be bankrupt.
Yeah, you need to have money to... Yeah, or... Well, in yeah, exactly. You need to be... I mean, from our point of view, obviously, we'll deal with a number of these situations. But, I mean, every now and then, you'll take it on the chin and deal with it on the basis of costs. But, you know, it is a situation... You know, when you look at the class action scenario, which I was talking about earlier... That is so much something that should come into Irish law, and it should come in, and I know it's been considered by the President of the High Court.
But legal people like yourself, you've got a very powerful lobbying voice, John. I mean, why?
Oh, yeah, but, you know. Yeah, well, I suppose we have, and we do have a lobbying voice, and we are, the Law Society has lobbied.
So why is there not an appetite for this?
Well, think about it for, you know, that's a very political question to ask me, but I mean, if you think about it for a second, would the banks want class actions? Would the major institutions want class actions? You know, if you have class action, it's leveling the playing field. You don't have as much of a David Goliath scenario.
What you're saying, you're making a very big statement there, because you're talking about the bank having enough influence on the government to...
enough influence on having enough of a pocket to be able to...
To fight this.
To be able... Well, if you look at all of this... I mean, if you look at the insolvency, this really has almost turned into a rant. I shouldn't have gone off on my holidays. But if you look at a situation where the insolvency legislation has been there for a couple of years now, if you look at all the changes that have been made in the insolvency legislation, and if you look, for example, on the right of appeal, where somebody, where I, as a personal insolvency practitioner, put up a proposal, and I put up a proposal that the family home be saved, and I put that proposal up, and it's rejected by the banks, there's a right of appeal to the courts. But the right of appeal is extremely limited. It's limited to certain very, very specific criteria. So despite the fact that from a political point of view, it looked like we were going to give a kind of a backup arbitrator decision maker to the refusal by the bank, it is very, very limited. So what I'm saying is that if you go down to the Circuit Court and look at the repossessions that have been done, if you go down to the High Court and you look at the repossessions, if you go down to every individual who's currently trying to deal with the banks, and we deal with a lot of these situations, if you don't have the money to fight it, which invariably, if you look at this situation, people don't, you're caught in a situation where you're literally being able to be pushed around by the person with the money, appeal it, refuse it, send it to the High Court, not accept the orders, etc. So there's a huge disparity.
It's very unfair.
In the system.
Yeah, it's very unfair. Yeah. Two things that strikes me. First of all, you know what the hip replacement case is?
Yes,
I thought, was there not some form of class action where that was concerned? No?
What they did with the hip, and yeah, you're right. We were involved in making a presentation at the High Court. I was involved in making a presentation at the High Court based on a mechanism to deal with the HIP cases without having to go into the High Court. But and I don't want to be splitting hairs with you. What the proposal that was made or what was suggested, a judge was nominated to deal with the Dupuy case. One judge, very sensible arrangement. One judge was, look, you'll deal with the Dupuy cases. And that judge then invited the legal people who were involved in, the people who were most involved in it, to make submissions to him to deal with claims by people through what we call an ADR process and an alternative dispute resolution process. So the alternative dispute resolution process, it was an alternative to the court as opposed to a class action, if you know what I mean. So what happened in the, or what is happening in the Dupuy cases, or the HIP cases as you call them, is that the court set up by agreement a mechanism whereby you can refer your case to an assessor, and the assessors are all retired High Court judges, litigators, people who are able to assess these cases, in order to speed up the process.
Right.
But it took it out of the legal system, because the class action is within the legal system.
And just briefly, is there any reason why that couldn't happen with the tracker debacle?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, the ADR is the current flavour of the
month.
But
the judiciary could make that decision, is that right?
Well, if somebody takes an action, and if there's multiple actions that are taken on the tracker mortgages, and if you're you're suddenly talking about large numbers. And the reason that the court decided to do it in the Dupuy case, or the HIP case, was that there were so many cases, they were flooding the list. I mean, we had a significant number of cases, and they were literally, you were going to get a situation where you were getting hearing dates a year hence, you know, and it literally was clogging up the list. So it's like, it is different to a class action. What it did was it literally took those cases out and put them aside,
right,
and said they're going to be dealt with through this assessment process. And
very,
that was the
very interesting indeed. We didn't get through all we were supposed to speak about today, but that was most interesting. Anyway, welcome back to you, John. And
thank you
thanks
very much,
indeed. And
thank
you'll
you.
Be down from your soapbox next week.
I will. I promise to get back to law next week.
John Lynch from Lynch Solicitors. All right, let's take a break. We're back with more Tip Today in a moment.
Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
And you're welcome back to Tip Today, 1800-938-007. That's our free phone number. Trudy is producing, and she'd be happy to hear from you. You can text me on 083-311-3311. Now, local political scientist Dr. Anthony O'Halloran will deliver three lectures on the origins of and prospects for the Trump presidency, and the lectures will be delivered at South Tipperary Arts Centre, Nelson Street in Clonmel, on Mondays the 20th, the 27th of November and the 4th of December from 7:30 to 9 p.m. And I'm delighted to say that Dr. Anthony O'Halloran is with me in studio, originally from Ardfinnan, Anthony.
Originally and still living there, and proudly, I will say my soul resides in Ardfinnan.
Very good indeed. But tell me a little bit about where you've been and what you've done, because you've been a lot of time in the States.
Yes, awarded a Fulbright scholarship in 2002. That brought me to Illinois. A transformative experience in my life, I have to say, utterly positive experience. Went back to Illinois, I think maybe for two more visiting positions. Headed for California spring 2006. So I went from the Midwest to virtually the Mexican border. And then I took a longer journey again. I decided to go from the Mexican border to the Canadian border. I ended up in Vermont for spring 2011 for one of their worst winters in living memory. I will never, ever forget the weather. So I like to think, apart from being an academic, because I've lived on the West Coast, I've taught in the Midwest, in New England, liberal New England, which is more like Europe than the United States.
Indeed, yeah.
I like to think I have a good sense of the United States. Now, I have to say, irrespective of any criticisms which we all have of Trump, like many, many Irish people, the United States has been very, very good to me personally. It's given me more than one break.
And it's interesting what you say, because I was lucky enough to travel and tour in the United States as well. And When we describe it over here, oh, those people over there in the United States, it's such diversity within the United States. It's incredible. It's almost hard to pigeonhole it all into one.
Well, I'll put it like this in very simple terms. I was picking oranges in California, and I was walking through snow in Vermont.
And that sums it up, doesn't it?
That sums it up. But it's part of the attraction of the States for me. Why did I keep going back? It was that diversity. It's a huge country. I mean, as I say, literally from the Mexican border to Vermont on the Canadian border and everything in between. The miracle of the United States for me as a political scientist is that it has remained the United States rather than a disunited States, although it is becoming more disunited as we speak, you know.
Is it?
It's a highly polarized country. There's one aspect of it I dislike intensely. It is how polarized politics is in the United States. You're either in one camp or the other. You have to tick all the boxes in one camp or tick all the boxes in the other camp. The danger going forward for the United States is that there's no middle ground anymore. The middle center ground has virtually disappeared in the United States.
Right. And there doesn't appear to me to be a left either, is there?
Not a left in European terms, certainly. No, there's not a left in European terms, although in New England, in some of the New England states, particularly Vermont, liberal Democrats would be pretty close, I would say, to European social Democrats in terms of their policy preferences.
Right.
You move to the Midwest, it's totally different, of course.
Well, what happened to the left of Woody Guthrie and the politics of the 60s? What happened to that? Did that just disappear?
I think we probably have to take into account a critical juncture in ideological history, which was the Thatcherite Reaganite axis. Reagan, 88, Thatcher, as you know, went in 79, left in 1990. So there was an ideological dominance of the right in the States. Now, again, to be objective in terms of Reagan, I had forgotten an absolutely critical fact. In the 84 election, Walter Mondale only won one state against Ronald Reagan, his home state, plus the District of Columbia. I mean, talk about a landslide. He pulverized Walter Mondale in 84. So it's quite extraordinary.
We talk about Trump as if this has come out of the blue somewhere, this right thing. But there you have Reagan.
We can exaggerate the significance of Trump in many ways. The fact of the matter is, I'm a little bit more sanguine in terms of the American system, for example.
Yes.
More optimistic. The system is actually working. Insofar as from the very beginning, the judicial branch in particular, the federal court said to him in terms of policies which he was bringing in around immigration, no, Mr. President, you cannot do that. So the judicial branch, including Democratic and Republican nominees, such as Carter, whether it was a Carter nominee or a Bush nominee, were saying, Mr. President, you must behave in accordance with the law. Now, I knew as a political scientist that, and we all know, it's true of Tipperary politics, it's true of Irish politics. Campaigning is one thing, opposing is another thing, but what we all know is governing is an entirely different proposition. And the American system makes it very, very difficult, almost impossible by deliberate design, for the president to prevail.
All right. Take me back to the campaign. So, I mean, nobody thought, it's a bit like the Brexit situation, nobody thought he was going to be president. Is it due to the Hillary Clinton thing that she just wasn't acceptable to the people? Is that why he's president, really, at the end of the day?
Yeah, I suppose, yes. Again, I'll put on my objective hat here. She did gain almost 3 million more votes than Trump, so she won the popular vote substantially. It was only a 2% gap. I think there's one or two factors which haven't been mentioned in the debate at all. Since the post-war era, only on one occasion has the same political party won 3 consecutive general presidential elections. And that was under Reagan and Bush. The Democrats were looking for a third term. 3 terms, 12 years in the White House. That's a challenge. The other shocking figure for me is looking at the Gallup poll satisfaction ratings on Congress. I mean, this is, again, I find this extraordinary. The satisfaction ratings recently have gone as low as 13% for Congress. There is deep antipathy in the United States towards DC politics. And the further you go away from DC into the Midwest where I lived, the deeper that hostility becomes. And there's a general suspicion in American culture around government anyway, for historical reasons. Many Americans do not like the idea of government intervening too much. They think government should mind its own business and let the free market get on with it. Put all those factors together, I think the fact that he was an outsider, he pulverised his fellow Republicans in the primaries, pulverised them. And yes, we all have to have our mea culpa moments and our hands up. A friend of mine said to me, Fran, I'd say a few days before the election, Anthony said, you know, we might have another Brexit moment. And I said, not going to happen. The blue wall fell apart. Pennsylvania went, Wisconsin went. I think the greatest mistake we all made in terms of political analysis was relying on this blue wall, in other words, states which were certain to go to the Democrats, that they were invincible, when in fact they were anything but invincible. And I well remember watching the CNN coverage that night when the whole concept of the blue wall started to implode. And Fran, implode it did as a concept and in reality.
It struck me, Anthony, that Trump wasn't ready for this. I mean, I don't think he had the belief himself that he was going to do this.
No, I can say, to use the phrase of modern, I suppose, the modern labour market, and I'm being kind to him in putting it this way, perhaps I shouldn't be so kind to him, he does not have the skill set to be president on a whole host of levels. Number one, the system demands in the United States that you have to negotiate. He controls both houses of Congress at the moment.
Yeah.
And the White House, and he has been unable to get any significant piece of legislation through either house, possibly unprecedented in the first year of the presidency. So there was this kind of narrative, I am the great negotiator. That narrative has collapsed. That narrative has been found to be an utter fiction. So I don't think he has the skill set. I don't think he's capable of discharging.
He certainly hasn't the diplomacy anyway.
He hasn't. My biggest worry is, I think what you need, you know, obviously we all have our own particular biases, but what we all want of a US president is that he or she, number one, is a rational, sober and measured person. That's one. To put it in simple terms, if you were Taoiseach, Fran, and appointing someone will say to the Department of Justice, it would not be unreasonable of you to take into account that that person would be a safe pair of hands in that particular ministry. He does not meet any of those requirements. Fortunately, there are significant systemic restraints, and secondly, there are good people around him trying to restrain him as well. So it's not maybe as dire as some of the narrative would suggest.
Right. Will you stay with me for a moment, because I must take a break. If you want to join in the conversation, by the way, 083-311-3311, and Dr. Anthony O'Halloran is staying with us.
If it matters to you, it matters to us. Call TIP today on 1-800-938-007.
Welcome back to TIP Today. Now, Dr. Anthony O'Halloran is still with me, and just to remind you, he will deliver three lectures on the origins of and the prospects for the Trump presidency, and that's all happening at the wonderful South Tipperary Arts Centre on Nelson Street in Clonmel. I'll give you those dates again in a few moments. A lot of talk in the last while about the possibility of him, of Trump being impeached. That would take so long, it's unlikely, is it?
I reckon a 50-50 chance.
Oh, do you?
I reckon a 50-50 chance, yeah. It's cumbersome. Clinton, just to clarify, Clinton was actually impeached, but there's a second stage to the process which you have to be convicted by the Senate. The American system is all built on this notion of checks and balances. You don't give too much power to one house, you spread it out. It really depends on Special Prosecutor Mueller and what data, what information, and what evidence he comes
up
with.
Is this the Russian involved?
Yeah, that's special. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if it were to happen. Now, I'm not saying it's a certainty. I would say it's somewhere between a possibility and a probability, which is a kind of a, right. Like a politician's dad, so really sitting on the fence.
The fact that he's Republican Party is a little embarrassed about him at times. Will that help, do you think, for that to happen?
He is not of the Republican Party. That is the difficulty.
Was his background not Democratic at one stage, was it?
His background, I think, is himself. I heard a scary phrase about him on BBC Newsnight last week, that he doesn't owe allegiance to any empirical reality in the world at all, other than the empirical reality that suits them for the moment. Now, that is something which certainly should concern us, yeah? I would say that the establishment Republicans, like the Bush family, for example, would treat him, I'd say, with considerable disdain. That would be the reality. So he would not be loved by the Republicans, but if he were to help Republicans get elected in the midterms, congressional self-interest kicks in. If being attached to Trump gets me re-elected to Congress, of course, considerations like that are suspended in the interest of getting your seat in the House. And the midterms are next year, by the way. That's the next one to look out for, Fran, the midterms.
Right, so the practicalities of the whole business of politics, it's amazing, isn't it? And tell me about where, because I hear it bandied around this country all the time, oh, if only Michael O'Leary took charge of the government, everything would be wonderful. Yeah. You know what I mean? He'd look at it in a pragmatic way. Yeah. So here's the example of a businessman.
How frank can I be with you?
Absolute,
total and complete nonsense.
Nonsense.
Now, running a business is not the same as running a political department as being prime minister. Chief executives can largely prevail within their own organisations. In politics, you're trying to satisfy hosts and hosts of different people with multiple preferences, competing preferences, and very, very often diametrically opposing preferences. Different skill set again. I have never subscribed to the Michael O'Leary scenario of parachuting businessmen or others in that particular genre into the government, the departments of government, or becoming prime ministers. It's a false equivalence, basically.
How dangerous is this banter with Kim Jong-un? Where is that going to end? Because you have two people with dodgy intellects with huge amounts of power.
Yeah, again, there isn't acknowledgement that this could go wrong. And there isn't acknowledgement that unintended consequences can occur. I guess people are hoping that China are working behind the scenes, that Russia are working behind the scenes. People are hoping, again, that those around Trump in the foreign policy sphere and his chief of staff, that they are, and they are, I believe, behaving in a measured and sober way, and that they are acting as a restraint. Sure. Could it go wrong? Of course, out of 10, it most certainly could go wrong. I mean, what number out of 10, I don't know.
Are there not hawks around Trump, though, in some way? Are there not warlords with an interest for a military reaction? Are those people there?
You will have, I suppose, kind of those of what would describe themselves as a realpolitik persuasion.
Yes.
And they would be the very opposite now, we'll say, to John Kerry. I almost said the late John Kerry. Forgive me. John Kerry, as someone's seen in, he's alive and well, thank God.
Well, yes.
But John Kerry's, I suppose, view would be one of diplomacy, one of interaction, trying to start things out through talk. The flip side of being a hawk, and there is a flip side, Americans don't want feet on the ground in terms of their military across the world. Mm. And we know from Vietnam and subsequent conflicts what changes public opinion, sadly, are the body bags coming home. So it's easy to talk tough on Fox. It's easy to talk tough on CNN. It's easy to go on to talk radio and talk tough. But there is another reality. When the military goes in, whether by air or on the ground, the context then changes totally.
Right, but did it not help greatly George Bush Jr. when he sort of got all tough following 9/11? And didn't that boost him? Because he was in the toilet before that, really, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, it's not an unreasonable analysis. I compare it to Margaret Thatcher, her back being to the wall until the Falklands. I mean, it has often been suggested to me, for probably listeners of my age, 50 now, that Thatcher was in dire trouble were it not for the Falklands presenting her with an opportunity for a political comeback. I think that is a reasonable comment. Of course, ultimately, Bush got his two terms as president. Then Obama had this marvelous exercise of mobilization when he was elected in, I think, 2008, was it? Mm. So a kind of a seminal moment in the US. And the sadness for me as well, Fran, at the moment, and it is a sadness, is that the whole issue of race is very much to the fore again in US politics.
Right. I think you mean with the Mexicans?
African Americans, yeah, you know. Yeah. One of the figures, I mean, just to tell you how polarized the country is, 88% of African Americans voted for Clinton, 8% for Trump. Like, so, you know, it's very...
That's an incredible figure.
It is, yeah. Now, that's no surprise. That has been the case since Lyndon Baines Johnson's presidency in the 1960s. But again, it's worth saying the United States was a legally segregated society. I say legally, not socially, mm-hmm. segregated society in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And I tell my students...
In living memory, you know.
And it was illegal under state law for African Americans and whites to marry, for example. Interracial marriage.
Up until when?
Late 60s, overruled by the Supreme Court in the late 60s. There was even a famous case of an African American... a couple being arrested, an interracial marriage. So if you're a white and if you're African-American and you fell in love, it was deemed illegal. So, you know, this is, you know, we think of the whole issue of race in the United States as being a 19th century phenomenon in racism. Lyndon Baines Johnson had to pull everything out of the political book, by the way. In the 60s, to get the Civil Rights Act and the Voter Registration Act through Congress. Washington was still a segregated city. Washington, D.C. was still a segregated city in the mid-1960s, and certainly at the time.
Isn't that incredible to contemplate? And it does bring me along to Obama, because I remember the night he made the speech, the acceptance speech, there were tears in my eyes. I said, this is it. We have it now. This is the game changer for the world. And he let us all down, didn't he?
There are costs, I would say, in fairness to him, there, I suppose it depends how we define let us down, and we can look at it in terms of hard policy preferences. I would say, given American culture and given the restraints any president faces, Obamacare was a very significant policy success. But I'm looking at it a little bit differently since he's left office. And the longer he's out of office, I've come to realize, and I think most of us can agree on this, Fran, is the fact that both he and Michelle, they brought dignity to the office in the White House. You mightn't agree with his policy perspectives, you mightn't be a liberal Democrat as he was, but there was certainly a sense that he carried the weight of the office with dignity and with great ease.
Did you expect more from him?
I didn't.
Realistic as well. What we were expecting.
I didn't actually. I wrote about this in the Clonmel lecture.
Did you? Not?
I did. I didn't. When you're studying politics as long as I am, you become as much aware as the constraints as you do of the possibilities. The reality, again, for historical reasons, the American political system is actually designed to thwart decision making and to thwart the exercise of power. Now, that might sound an extraordinary statement to make, but that is the constitutional reality. It's unlike here, for example, the Senate and the House are equal partners. It's not like the Dáil here that can prevail over the Senate, an entirely different scenario. We're looking at a situation where the president controls both houses at the moment, both houses, and controls the White House, and he cannot get legislation through. So it's very, very, very difficult. Now, there are some examples of game changers. The LBJ presidency, Fran, was a real game changer in terms of domestic policy, both anti-poverty legislation and civil rights legislation. FDR again, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal post the Wall Street crash when he came in 1933. Reagan again with that ideological axis of Reagan and Thatcherite, utterly significant in terms of changing the world of political ideas, I would put it to people. Carter, I would say 4 years, and his presidency would have been perceived as a failure, but an outstanding ex-president, most people would agree.
Very much so. And a great envoy around the world absolutely. For the States as well. Can I just mention those dates again? Do you have to log in for
you just phone, yeah. phone my, is my number there, Frank?
It is indeed. Is that 087-601?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
087-601-3637 if you want to register to go along to Anthony's talks even. South Tipperary Arts Centre. It kicks off on Monday the 20th. It's also on the 27th, and finally on Monday the 4th of December from 7:30 until 9:30. You'll be talking, but I presume there'll be a chance for people to question.
Oh yeah, my style, the fancy language is discursive. In other words, as we say in our Finnan and Care, we'll have a bit of a chat as well.
Absolutely. So we'll, do you know, I could talk to you all day. I was fascinated with the last half hour.
Well, I'm not asking you to bring me back in, but I'm prepared to come back in, okay? Well,
we'd love to have you anytime. Look after yourself, Anthony.
God bless
Thanks
you.
Very much
God
indeed.
Bless you.
Dr. Anthony O'Halloran. All right, we'll be back with some of your comments after these.
Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
And Trudy joins me with a look at what's coming in on text, Trudy.
A variety of different things, and because we haven't got to the text yet, I'll just kind of go back a little to the start, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Just in relation to the property tax the properties and renting, a caller got in touch to say they're very reassured to hear the ESRI says the property market isn't overheating. I definitely don't remember hearing anything like that before. When property prices were flying up out of control. So I think someone is very much their tongue in cheek.
Indeed.
There. In relation to the roads, there are two potholes on the bridge in Thurles. They won't even fix them. You better find that person that won that lotto, because they might do it for them. And indeed, there is no word yet, I think, on that person that won that lotto in Thurles, and fair play to them. Jimmy Ryan's basically on a soccer field at the moment. Ole, 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 go on Ireland. So there we are. That's where he's thinking.
So say all of us. It's going to be a great game tonight.
It is. Nail-biting stuff. Mm-hmm. Back to legal issues. This is in relation to the crime and the meeting last night. Get rid of free legal aid on repeat offenders. Let them pay it out of their own pocket. Lock them up on Spike Island. Our prisons are like hotels. That's Catherine Doran in Thurles. She says the judges need to wake up and lock up those prisoners. Another along the same vein. It makes my blood boil to see the state of the... Oh, no, actually not. Of the Clonmel Arms Hotel these past few weeks in particular. When is somebody going to wake up and do something
about
it?
Well, there's talks about it happening.
There is talks, but yeah. There's been talks for many years that I've been here. Don got in touch. Hi, Fran and crew. Could this yet be another example of manipulating the figures? This is in relation to the meeting where the Gardaí said they had one reported incident in Cool Derry, and the local said, well, there was over 30. Don says, Fran, the superintendent says one and the community says 30. Something's definitely wrong there. And he doesn't believe it's because of the non-reporting of incidents.
Very interesting. By the way, Trudy, mm-hmm. You make great coffee.
Once and only, and it's only because you had a guest in studio. I actually had to ask how you take it.
Yeah, steady now, steady. Thanks, Trudy.